How valuable is life? It may sound like a philosophical question, but it really has some very practical ramifications. And there are a whole bunch of different answers to it. On one end of the spectrum, there's Hinduism that teaches that all life is sacred, and therefore you should kill nothing at any time for any reason. As you've heard me say before, for a number of years I was the speaker at a camp up in Canada. And one year we had a fella on the campsite that was a Hindu. And he objected to us killing mosquitoes because all life is sacred. Somehow, when you're being bit by them, that's hard to swallow. But even in India, the cows are sacred, so they won't kill a cow. In the meantime, people are starving to death. But life is sacred, and you can't kill anything. As a matter of fact, I read recently a story where a man that didn't buy the point of view killed a cow to eat it, and they killed him. Stormed his house and killed him. On the other end of the spectrum, these are the two extremes, life has no value at all, at least some life, so that it's cheap. They think nothing of killing people, even innocent people. And of course, the people that are like that today are the terrorists who would just go in and blow up innocent people to make a point. For them, their life may have value, but nobody else's life does, that doesn't have their point of view. So just how valuable is life? How valuable is human life? And maybe we should throw in the mix, how valuable is animal life? In America today, there's no consensus on this subject and a lot of confusion. The majority of people in this country want the right to kill an unborn, they would say fetus, we would say baby. They want the right to terminate life when it's elderly and near death. But they don't want the government to execute criminals. Now, is that an interesting mix or what? In other words, they want the right to abortion and they want the right to euthanasia, but they don't want capital punishment. So on the one hand, they're willing to kill innocent people, but they don't want to kill guilty people. So this subject needs to be thought through. It has some profound practical ramifications. To add to the confusion, an increased number of people support abortion and euthanasia, that is the killing of the young and the old, and then they picket and politic for animal rights. So it's okay to kill an unborn baby or an elderly person that doesn't have much left than, so to speak, but we don't want you to kill an animal. And I've known people that would not eat meat because you had to kill an animal in order to eat meat. So I say, this subject needs to be thought through biblically. What is the value of human life? What is the value of animal life? Is all life sacred so that we should not practice any kind of killing, including abortion, euthanasia, capital punishment, or animals for food? Is it that sacred? And if it's not, how do you make the distinction? How can you say kill one and not kill the other? I think the most consistent position would be that you don't kill any life at all. At least there's some kind of consistency. And if you want to slice and dice that subject up so that you want to have the ability to kill animals to eat them, like fried chicken on Sunday, then how do you make the distinction? Where do you draw the line? How valuable is life, and how do you know? God once destroyed all living life, except for a handful of people, both animals and humans, except for an ark full. Let's put it like that. What does that say about life? Well, God himself clarifies that question. At the time, he saved that boat full of people. So that's what I want us to look at, to get some clarity, to help us to think through this subject and find the key to when we know when to kill and when not to kill. So what does God say about the value of life? At the end of Genesis chapter 8, God said to himself that he would never again destroy every living thing with a flood. That's at the end of chapter 8 and verse 21. He would allow life to continue in its natural process. That's verse 22. In a sense, then, the next passage, which begins at Genesis chapter 1, chapter 9, verse 1, and goes through verse 17, is a repetition of that decision. God gives commands to Noah concerning life in Genesis chapter 9. Life is to continue, as he's made that clear in chapter 8. He makes a covenant concerning life in chapter 9, so that life will never be destroyed, all of life, at least by a flood. So this passage really has to do with life, and I think gives us some basis for thinking through all these various issues like abortion, euthanasia, capital punishment. So turn with me to Genesis chapter 9 and let's see what God says. Genesis chapter 9, verse 1. So God created Noah and his sons, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast on the earth, on every bird of the air, and all that move on the earth, and all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs, but you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. Surely, for your life blood, I will demand a reckoning from the hand of every beast. I will require it, and from the hand of man, from the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply. Bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply in it." Then God spoke to Moses and to his sons with him, saying, "As for me, behold, I establish a covenant with you and your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth. Thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." And God said, "This is the sign of the covenant which I made between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I will set my rainbow in the clouds, and it shall be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be when I have a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. The waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud. And I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth." And God said to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth." Now, a lot here, but what's here is basically pretty simple. The whole 17 verses can be divided basically into two parts. The first thing that he does is he sort of gives some commands pertaining to life in general. And then in the latter part of the passage, he makes a covenant. So I want us to go back and work our way through these verses and establish some principles or concepts for how we handle the subject of the value of life. The first thing that he does, it seems to me, is that he argues for the promotion of life. So look at verse 1. He says, "So God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth.'" I want to promote life. I want you to go multiply and fill the earth. Now at this point, in the context of Genesis and the flood in particular, the waters have receded. The ark is now empty. The animals have been scattered all over the earth. And so God comes to Noah, who has already offered a sacrifice even. And he says, "Now, this is what I want you to do. I want to promote life in this planet. I like life. I want you to fill the planet with life." Now, this is close to what he said to Adam. Remember Adam, Genesis chapter 1, when God created Adam and Eve, it says in chapter 1, he blessed them and said to them, quote, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." It's in chapter 1, verse 28. Now, he repeats that. But listen carefully. He doesn't repeat all of it. The only part he repeats is, "Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth." What he does not repeat is, "Subdue it and have dominion over it." So the question is, why doesn't he repeat that? And apparently, the fall has affected the original intent God had. And so man is not to subdue and have dominion over the earth, quite like Adam was to do it before the fall. Some have suggested that Satan now has dominion over the earth, and that man will never have dominion over it until the Son of Man comes and he subdues it and has dominion over it. In the meantime, this verse is telling us, man is to populate the earth. He is to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth with his kind. No place is to be unoccupied or uncultivated. So, the first thing God establishes concerning life is, I want to promote it. I want you to populate the earth. The second thing is in verse 2. He says, "And the fear of you and the dread of you should be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, and on all that moves on the earth, and all of the fish in the sea. They are given into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you." That's different. We hadn't seen that before. "I have given you all things, even as the green herbs, but you shall not eat flesh with its life," that is, its blood. So the second thing he does in this passage is he makes provision for life. He wants to promote it. He wants you to fill the earth. And now he's going to make provision for it. So he not only commands Noah and his sons and his family to populate the earth. He provides animals for food to sustain human life on the earth. So beasts, birds, bugs, fish of the sea will now fear and dread human beings. Without this animal population, the animal population might control humans and maybe even eliminate them. So, part of this provision is that man is to not fear animals. Animals are to fear man. Now, that's what this is saying. They shall fear you. You shouldn't they shouldn't fear you. You shouldn't fear them. But that isn't what happens, is it? Any animal you fear? Snakes? Bugs? I remember the first job I ever had, I was in the ninth grade. They didn't mail out the water bills. We hand-delivered them, put them in the door, at least where I grew up. And that was my job. And so that meant I had to go through yards with dogs. And one of the things they said is, if you're afraid of the dog, he knows it. So don't be afraid of the dog. Stare him down. That was good for some dogs. Maybe that was good for advice for me, the small ones. The bigger ones got to me sometimes. At any rate, no matter how big or how strong, animals are to dread humans and not vice versa. That's part of what he's saying in this passage. Now, God told Adam in chapter 1, "See, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of the earth, and every tree that yields fruit, that yields seed, and it shall be your food." It's in chapter 1, verse 29. But nothing is said about meat in chapter 1. Some have actually used that to suggest that God intended for us to be vegetarians, that we should not eat meat. If humans ate meat before the flood, it was not by divine sanction. Nothing is said about eating meat prior to Genesis chapter 9. Now, God gives human beings the permission to eat meat for the first time. He doesn't explain why he made the change. And any explanation I might offer, or for that matter, anybody else, is only speculation. At this point, we can say God does not make a distinction between clean and unclean. Moses does that later. Now, you know what that means? When God said in this passage, "Noah, I want you to eat meat. I want you to eat all the animals, all the birds, the fish. It's all open. You can have it." That meant that he could eat bacon and pork chops. Right? That restriction, that distinction between clean and unclean, and the pig was unclean, and they couldn't eat it, was imposed by Moses. And that came years later. So I find it fascinating. We go from a strict vegetarian diet, to eat anything you want, to, well, you can't eat unclean animals, things like shrimp and pork. And then, in the New Testament, he goes back to Noah and says, now everything's okay. You can eat it all. So, God has changed the program several times. That is called dispensationalism. He changes his program. And that's what that amounts to. So with the new prohibition, there's also a provision, I should say. There's also a prohibition. He then says, you can eat meat, but you can't eat blood. Now, who would think to do that? And by the way, there are many civilizations where they do that. The question is, why did God not do that in this passage? Which he says in verse 4, that you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, with its blood. So apparently what he's saying is, if you're going to eat an animal, drain the blood out of it first, because life is in the blood. That's the principle. So I don't want you to eat life. I want you to eat the meat. I don't want you to eat the life. And this is where the Jews get the idea of kosher. That the meat has to be drained properly in order for you to eat it if you are a strict or orthodox Jew. This probably excludes eating live animals. And there are some civilizations where that's done. But more than likely, this is really aimed at properly drain the blood out of the meat before you eat it. The significance of this prohibition, then, is beyond the physical act of eating flesh with blood. The idea is the life is in the blood. So the point of the prohibition is that people are not to eat flesh as long as it has blood in it. Life is valuable and is to be respected. It's the life part of this that we don't want to tamper with. So that's embedded in even the command to eat meat. All right, so far he said, I want you to fill the earth. I want to promote life. And then I want to provide meat to sustain life. And by the way, there are some people that are vegetarians. But there are, you need animal food for protein. Now, you can get protein out of veggies. As a matter of fact, but they're not complete proteins. But if you eat a bean and rice, it's a complete protein. But even if you do that and get protein out of vegetables, you still cannot get vitamin B12. Vitamin B12 only comes from eating animals. So if you're going to be a vegetarian, A, don't blame that on Genesis. That boat won't float. And B, if you're going to be a vegetarian, take some B12 supplements, or you can have some problems. All right, there's one more principle in here before we get to the covenant. And that is, he wants to protect life. So, moving from the subject of animal food to human blood, God says, surely for your life, I'm starting in verse 5 now, surely for your life blood, I will demand a reckoning from the hand of every beast, and I will require it from the hand of man. From the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of man. All right, here's what's going on. You can kill an animal. That's verse 3. But neither animal nor humans may kill a human being. That's verse 5. Animal blood is not to be eaten, and human blood is not to be shed. So, this is really interesting stuff. Kill an animal, that's fine. Eat an animal, that just don't eat the blood. But you don't kill a human being. You don't do that. Matter of fact, he says in this verse, I will require that if you kill somebody else, if you kill a human being, whether an animal does it or a human does it, I will require. Do you see that in verse 5? Well, that's a judicial term. God at this point is acting like a judge, and he's pronouncing punishment on an animal or a human who sheds the blood of another human. And the punishment is death of the guilty one. God requires life of the taker of life. Earlier, God promised that someone killed Cain, they would be responsible. Remember that? But that was just restricted to Cain. What he does now is he extends it. He takes that principle and extends it. From the hand of every man's brother, he says in verse 5, I will require it. Now, if you think about it, at this point, except for Noah, everybody was a brother. There were only three, and they were all brothers. And yet there's a sense in which the human family all comes from the same parent, in this case Noah, as well as Adam. And so in that sense, we are all brothers. Now, God says this, if you kill a human being, the punishment is you get killed. So this is getting real interesting. Life is valuable, sacred, but you can kill animals, but you can't kill a human. But if you kill a human, you get killed. Interesting? How would you ever figure that out? Apart from revelation, you wouldn't. Some have suggested that it is at this point that God establishes government. Who's going to execute this command? Is it going to be personal? Are you going to take it upon yourself to do that? No, that's murder. But when the group does it, the society does it, that's government, and that's what God is giving here, is the first formation of human government. Those who call themselves dispensationalists mark this as that's part of this dispensation. God's changing his program now, and it's the dispensation of human government. He's establishing government. Prior to this, there was no government, and there was no law. Moses hadn't come along yet. It was conscience. God gave you a consciousness of sin. Now he's going to establish some social dictates. Luther said, quote, this was the first commandment having reference to the temporal sword. By these words, temporal government was established and the sword placed in its hand by God. So, the Bible makes clear, if a beast kills a human being, the beast is to be killed. If a human being willingly kills another human being, that person is to be executed. Now, if you want some clear biblical verses that spell all this out, besides Genesis 9, go to Exodus chapter 21. Exodus chapter 21, and look at verse 28. If an ox gores a man or a woman to death, then the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be acquitted. What happens when a pit bull kills somebody? You're going to follow the scripture, not just the Mosaic law. Genesis 9, what would happen? The pit bull gets killed. All right, but look at verse 12 of the same chapter. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. Now, you need to mark that down because you need to know the Bible teaches capital punishment. And that's where it teaches it. If you kill somebody, then you shall be put to death. So there are two extremes in regard to human government. One is to disregard government. That's anarchy. The other extreme is to regard government higher than God. Believing that government can solve the problems that government was never designed to solve. But one of the responsibilities of government is to practice capital punishment. That's clearly revealed in the Mosaic law and before the Mosaic Law. So this supersedes the Mosaic Law. Now let me ask a question. Why can humans kill animals, but neither animals nor humans can kill humans? Do you see any inconsistency here? How do you make that distinction? And by the way, this is a real problem in our society today, that people that don't have a biblical orientation can't quite figure this out. So they are. It's easy for them to come up with something like all life is sacred, you can't kill anything at any time for any reason. Or, well, I think women should have a choice, and so abortion's okay, and yeah, elderly people should have the choice if they want to take their own life, and but don't kill animals. So how do you think through all this? What's the dividing line? Well, let's go back to the passage and look at verse 6. God explains, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. Note that. That's what we've been looking for. What makes life sacred? Well, God gave it to us. But what makes human life more sacred than animal life? Why can you eat animals and not eat humans? Why can you be a meat eater but not a cannibal? And the answer is, because human beings are made in the image of God. So humans are more valuable than animals because humans are made in the image of God. Thus the sin, or if you will, the crime of taking another human life is so great that justice demands that the killer be killed. Now, what I just said is really the dividing line here. Human life is so sacred, it's so valuable because we're created in the image of God, that if you mess with that, you kill that, you have forfeited your right to live and you should die. It's not stated here, but I think implied here is that this is not only the way to have justice, but I think there's also implied here maybe a word about prevention. If we practice capital punishment, do you think it would help prevent murder? By the way, what could be more relevant right now? And they're saying guns kill people. Guns do not kill people. People kill people. Well, what do you do when people kill people? You kill them. And I'm suggesting that if we did that, that might be a little bit of a deterrent. Well, yeah, but we kill people. It doesn't deter anything. Why doesn't it? Do you know the answer to that? You know the biblical answer to that? Do we practice capital punishment? Does it work in the sense of preventing? No. Why not? Because we have so many appeals. If you get convicted of a capital crime, you won't be executed for probably in the neighborhood of 25 years. I saw recently a piece on TV where they talked about people on death row, and they'd been there, some of them, 25 years. And they still got appeals coming. So turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 8, and let me show you how to make this work. Ecclesiastes chapter 8, and this has to be applied if you're going to believe in capital punishment. Verse 11, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, the hearts of the Son of Man is fully set in them to do evil. The key to making capital punishment preventative is that it has to be done swiftly. That is critical to getting this done properly. So, it's not stated in Genesis 9, but I think it's clearly stated in Ecclesiastes chapter 8. So, this little part of the passage concludes in verse 7. God again says, "And you will be fruitful and multiply and bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply in it." By the way, he started with that in verse 1, and he says it again in verse 7. Almost the same thing. That's a literary technique where it frames the discussion. It states something here, and it states the same thing at the end. They even have a technical word for it. It's called an inclusio. It means that we're going to have a restatement that frames the discussion. It strengthens the unity of the discussion and also highlights the prominent idea in it. All right, here's the sum of everything I've said so far. Humans are not to take life. They are to produce, promote life, and populate the planet with it. Human life, which is in the image of God, is valuable. And that's the key, I think, to this passage. Humans are made in the image of God. Therefore, human life is more valuable than animal life, and human life is not to be tampered with. Now, there's more to this passage. Beginning in verse 8, going through verse 10, God makes a covenant. He spoke to Noah, verse 8, and his sons, saying, "And as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants, and with every living thing that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the field with you, and all that go out from the ark, every beast of the earth." So verse 7 says, "As for you," now he says in verse 9, "As for me, I will make a covenant with Noah and all human beings and all creatures." By the way, it's been argued that the phrase "and all that go out of the ark" indicates a universal flood, or otherwise not all animals would be included. An interesting point. But the real point here is this. God makes a covenant, and then he says the content of it is in verse 11. "Thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all the flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." So God unconditionally promises that he will never again destroy all flesh on the earth with a flood. Local floods, maybe. Universal floods, never. And we've seen floods kill people even this week. There's one more thing that goes on in this passage. In verses 12 to 17, God gives a sign of the covenant. And the sign of the covenant you are very familiar with. He, in this section, assures and reassures us that he will not destroy flesh with a flood. He establishes a covenant in verses 8 through 11. Then, as if to reassure us, he establishes a sign of that covenant, the rainbow. And that's in verses 12 to 17. So it emphasizes that the rainbow is for us. That God says, "I'm going to give you a rainbow." God takes no pleasure in destruction and death. Life is too precious to him. Hence, he makes an unconditional, universal, everlasting covenant with all flesh to never again destroy the earth with a flood. Again, because he values life. Wordsworth said, quote, "The bow in the hand of a man was an instrument of battle. The bow bent by the hand of God became a symbol of peace. And of course, what he's talking about is a rainbow, not a bow and arrow. With all due respect to Wordsworth, I said Wadsworth, it's Wordsworth. I should say the bow in the hand of man was an instrument of death, but the bow bent by God is a sign of life. At any rate, I think this passage, all 17 verses, is highlighting the value of life. And the big key is that humans are made in the image of God, and that's what gives human life value. So the sum is that after God issued commands to man to promote and protect human life, he made an unconditional, everlasting covenant with all flesh to never again destroy the earth with the flood, and he established the rainbow as a sign of the covenant. Let me conclude by making a couple of observations. The passage gives us, it seems to me, the basis for formulating a view of the value of life. You know, if you didn't have the Bible, why not just treat humans like animals? And people that don't have the Bible do. The extreme are the cannibals. They eat each other. Or you come up with some view where you can slaughter innocent people just because you decide to do that, because they don't agree with your religion. If you didn't have the Bible, you wouldn't have this sense of the value of life. So here are the principles. Human life is valuable because humans are made in the image of God. That's the one thing we ought to walk away with from this passage. Number two, human life is so sacred that anyone, whether it be a human or an animal, who takes human life forfeits life. And that's a critical distinction in trying to think through this subject. And then thirdly, but animals who are not made in the image of God can be eaten for food. Now you get those three principles down, and I think you have the basis for thinking through the value of life from a biblical point of view. This view avoids extremes, that all life is sacred, and therefore animals cannot be killed. Or the other extreme, that no life is sacred, and therefore it's cheap. It seems to me the determining factor is that humans and humans alone are made in the image of God and animals are not. And I submit to you that apart from that concept, that biblical revelation, people get it backwards. And our society has really gotten this backwards. So we kill unborn babies. And we want now to kill the elderly, and in some states that's now legal. But we object to killing killers and killing animals. We're not thinking straight. We're not thinking biblically, but you have to have God's revelation in order to know how to think about this subject. Now, I started out saying this is more than a philosophical discussion. There are some profound ramifications to this subject. This determines what you think about abortion. The scripture teaches that life begins at conception. Matter of fact, science now, with the discovery of DNA, has demonstrated that life begins at conception. The color of your eyes was determined at the moment of conception in the DNA. This also has something to say about euthanasia, the killing of elderly people. Do you have the right to take your life just because you're in pain? No. Do you have the right to take your life when you're elderly and you aren't functional or profitable to society? No. Should we allow doctors to teach people how to take their life? No. If you're thinking biblically, that is in the image of God and it's not to be tampered with. Well, if that's the case, then you don't believe in capital punishment. Oh, no. And for the same reason, because human life is so valuable that if you tamper with it, you just forfeited your own life. So if you're going to think biblically, you would be opposed to abortion on demand. You would be opposed to euthanasia, but you would be in favor of capital punishment. And I need to insert here that Christians have historically made some exceptions for abortion. If the one exception is that the life of the mother is in danger, then an abortion is permissible. It's not that it's good, it's that it's the lesser of two evils, is the way a Christian philosopher would say it. But the way we're doing abortion is we're killing people as a form of birth control. And that is abhorrent. Clearly unbiblical. Now you need to know this. You need to know this personally. If you come, you may be faced with either you personally or somebody you know that's come to you for advice about abortion or euthanasia. I mean, that gets to be intensely personal. The other area in which you need to know this is if you ever serve on jury duty and it's a capital offense. By the way, if you serve on jury duty and the issue is capital punishment, don't tell them it's your view because of the Bible, because if you do, they'll throw you out or the decision out. But I'm going to tell you the other area in which this is critically important. How about when we vote? How about when we vote? How do you vote for somebody who votes for abortion on demand? I don't know. How do you vote for somebody that's opposed to capital punishment? I don't know. So you're getting political. I am not getting political. I am getting very, very biblical. And the Bible ought to affect our political views. So I say, this ought to affect you in the jury box and in the voting booth. It is intensely practical, not to mention in your own personal life. So to state it all very, very simply, I am pro-life. That means I'm pro-life for that fetus. That's a human being. And I'm pro-life when you're 80 years old and bedridden. And I'm pro-life when you take life. To demonstrate how pro-life I am, I would vote that that person who took life just should have his life taken. Why? Because I believe human beings are made in the image of God. Animals are not. Father, give us discernment. Help us to think like you think. We know that your thoughts are higher than ours and your ways are higher than our ways. But Lord, we get confused sometimes because we don't think like you think. So give us clarity of thought and discernment and wisdom in applying these principles to life. Thank you for giving us your mind. In Jesus' name, amen.